Tonight, a history of the Knights Templar and the legendary Holy Grail like you've never heard before. For nearly 1,000 years, the Knights Templar have been regarded to be the eternal guardians of the Holy Grail. But what the Holy Grail actually is, well, has it been accurately revealed? Stand by. You may find out in a moment with our guest Mark Pinkham right here on Coast to Coast AM. Mark Pinkham is a Templar Knight, a lecturer, a historian, an international sacred tour leader, the author of a series of books that cover many of the secrets and mysteries that have been omitted from mainstream historical texts. Most recently, Mark joined with Ian Sinclair of Clan Sinclair, the builders of Roslyn Chapel, to form the International Order of Gnostic Templars. Ian and his wife Andrea currently direct the North American branch of this order in Sedona, Arizona. Mark also leads tours to places around the world that are or have been sacred to the Knights Templar. He's back as a guest on Coast to Coast AM. Hi, Mark. How are you?
Hi, George. It's a pleasure to be back. Thank you for having me.
Me too. I did not know the first time that you were indeed a Templar Knight. Tell me about that.
Well, it's happened rather quickly over the last 2 or 3 years since I first made the acquaintance with Ian Sinclair. I've made numerous journeys up to Scotland since then and visited Ian's preceptory, Templar preceptory, in northern Scotland called the Prince Henry St. Clair Templar Preceptory. And during that time, I've gone through a series of initiations. Actually, most recently, I became the Grand Prior of this order, of the International Order of Gnostic Templars, before I became squire and Templar Knight and went through the ranks, so to speak. And during that time period, we've also been taking a lot of other people up there for a special initiation from Ian Sinclair.
Is it a secret organization, Mark?
No, it isn't at all, George. And we certainly want to keep it that way. We feel that the truth, the wisdom, the knowledge, the light should be available for everybody. And we believe that the original mystery schools offered the true wisdom without having to go through secret initiations, that the wisdom was available for everybody, but that wisdom had to become secretive simply to protect itself from fundamentalist doctrines and those that were out to destroy anything that they didn't understand.
Now, when you say you're a Templar Knight, was this like being the same kind of Templar Knight that was back hundreds and hundreds of years ago that apparently are guarding, protecting the Holy Grail and things like that? Same kind of group?
There has been a continual lineage, and that's one thing that we're finding out now, that the Templars did survive even after their mass arrest in 1307 when it appeared as though the order had been dissolved. It does appear as though that the Templars did survive. Many of them went up into Scotland, for example, and there they became part of a Freemasonic organization called the Order of Herodom. And they were part of Freemasonry for many years until mid-1800s when a man named Alexander Duchar decided to give the Templars their own independent identity again. And then he established the Militi Templi Scotia, which is one of the Templar organizations of Scotland today. Well, when I met Ian Sinclair, he was a preceptor, initiator into the Militi Templi Scotia, but he was rather discouraged with the organization because he felt as though it should expand and become more international and invite in everybody and make the knowledge available to everybody. He decided to join with me to create an order that could do that.
We hear a lot, Mark, about the Templars and the Freemasons, and I got to tell you, I mean, a week can't go by without getting at least one email, one phone call from someone who's trying to connect the dots between what they are, what they were, that they are indeed secret societies, that some of them may be up to no good, though a lot of Masons will call my program and say, no, this is not true. What is the relationship, and what do you think about the Freemasons organization as well?
Well, obviously, there's a strong connection between the Templars and the Freemasons. The legend is that, as I just mentioned, a lot of the Templars that survived the mass arrest in 1307 just disappeared into Freemasonic organizations, and so they essentially transferred their ancient rites and mysteries and ideologies into Freemasonry, and you can see that today. For example, they say in the 17th and 18th degree of the Scottish Rite, the Knight of East and West and the Knight of the Rose Cross, these rites are actually based on ancient ceremonies and rituals that the Templar Knights themselves observed. And so there is a continuation there. There's a continuation basically between most all the secret societies in Europe and the Templars. Most all of them have some connection to the Templars, because the Templars were the first to really bring into Europe this the path of what we call Gnosticism, the path of intuitive wisdom, the path of knowing yourself without the aid of a book or a preacher or any kind of outer tool. We believe in the Gnostic path, the knowledge is within you, and it's just a matter of going in there and finding it. And we believe that the Templars found out how to do it via the Sufis and some of the teachers and masters they met in the Holy Land. And so most of these sects of secret societies, whether it's the Rosicrucians or Freemasons or even the Illuminati, basically they were based around creating a path of Gnosticism, of contacting that inner wisdom, that inner intuitive knowledge that's there within all of us. So that's kind of the string that binds them all together. You'll even find that Adam Weishaupt, who founded the Illuminati, he was essentially a Gnostic, and he wanted to break down all the institutions that were telling people what to believe so that they could, in a sense, find that inner wisdom, that inner knowledge, without being impeded in that process.
Mark, when I was reading your book, Guardians of the Holy Grail, it was almost like a historical nonfiction version of the Indiana Jones movies. because it is a mystery, and it is a journey, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It's pretty exciting, actually, George, because the more that you dive into the history, the more it reveals itself, and it does come out to be something like an Indiana Jones movie. For example, last time I was on, I talked about the Templars being initiated into a very, very ancient lineage in the Holy Land that went back thousands of years before they even arrived in the Holy Land, and goes all the way back to the east, and even begins in Sri Lanka many thousands of years before they even arrive. Of course, there's loads of legends about what the Templars were doing and the treasures that they found, and how they were digging around Solomon's temple for 9 years and then left with, one legend says they left with 5 crates of boxes after 9 years, and they took them up into Europe with them and then hid them from that point. Well, where did they hide them, and what was in them? These are rather intriguing questions, and I think we're starting actually to come up with some answers for them.
I want to talk with you a lot about Roslyn Chapel tonight, and also already people are calling to talk with you. We're going to wait until the third hour for that. But, Mark, tell me the significance of the Holy Grail. I want your definition of the Holy Grail, and what was the original version, the text of the Holy Grail, of course, was supposed to be, I think, the cup that Jesus drank from, was it not?
That's right. That's what we normally associate with being the Holy Grail. But actually, George, if you start looking around, you'll find that there are many Holy Grails, and they've been Holy Grails in existence thousands of years before Jesus even took birth. So these aren't just associated with him. There were chalices found in Sumeria, for example, that have mystical powers associated with them. There are stones and chalices from the Far East that are thousands of years older than Christianity. So the Holy Grail legend and myth and Holy Grail manifestations existed way before Jesus. But one thing you find if you start looking around and examining these Holy Grails is that they all have one thing in common, and that's if you hold one or if you're just in proximity to it, it can begin within you a process of alchemical transformation. That's because it holds a certain energy. It's emanating a certain energy, a transformative energy, and that energy, it got that energy from some great master like Jesus who held it or wore it. For example, the relics of the Passion, the crown of thorns, the cross, the nails of the cross, all these things have been ascribed the powers of a Holy Grail. And this is because they were all in proximity to Jesus' body, which was full of that power, that alchemical power, because in our tradition it's believed that Jesus was a great master who was full of power, Holy Spirit power, Kundalini power, whatever you want to call it, but he had that power that he could transmit his energy into a disciple and thereby begin that disciple's process of alchemical transformation. That power was given to the disciples, to the apostles on the day of Pentecost.
Well, tell me a little bit more about this transformation, though, if people were to touch some of these Holy Grails.
Well, I think you can see it today in some of the charismatic churches, even, like the Pentecostal churches, where people will come up and get touched, or through chanting and opening themselves up to the Holy Spirit, they'll start speaking in tongues, they'll start thrashing around, there'll be bodily movements. And this is what happens when that power, that energy starts to grab you, starts to be kindled within you. And I've been around that kind of energy for most of my life because when I was in my early 20s, I was initiated into a sect of yoga in India that begins with the transmission of that energy from a great master. And so for years living in ashrams, I saw that around me all the time, how that energy moves through somebody and how it transforms them as it opens them up ultimately to their Gnostic wisdom. That's what characterizes a Gnostic path such as ours, is that there's a transformation that goes on. There's an awakening of that energy, because you can have glimpses of Gnosticism, but to be totally established in that state of enlightenment means to go through a full-scale transformation so that you can really hold that power and that consciousness within yourself.
Give me an example, Mark, if you can, of something miraculous or just mysterious that may have occurred either during transformations that you might have witnessed or episodes like that.
Well, George, it was quite amazing that in the old days when I was living in these ashrams, as soon as the lights went down and it was time to meditate, people would start doing these very strange things. A man next to you could immediately start standing on his head. The one to the left of you could be hopping like a frog or barking like a dog, or there could be fast, rapid breathing that goes on. People could be having visions. It runs the whole gamut as to what people could experience. And I myself went through those experiences. I had many, many visions, astral travel. I mean, you name it. It seems to, like I said, run the gamut, all kinds of experiences. And these all are brought on through the volition of that power. As it leads you on your path, you always get exactly what you need at that time. It's a fully conscious power, fully aware within you. And you can call that a power of the goddess, you can call it Shakti, you can call it Kundalini, you can call it the Holy Spirit, whatever you want to call it. It's that spiral serpent at the base of the spine. It's the goddess energy is what it is. And this is why this is part of the goddess, the ancient goddess tradition. And this is one reason that we are reactivating and reviving this Gnostic Templar movement, because it's time to revive the ancient goddess tradition now, and this is a major part of this.
Is this also a higher form of consciousness?
Well, it it leads to the highest form of consciousness, George, which we call gnosis. And in gnosis, well, you actually go through phases as you move through gnosis. First, you get kind of a sense of us being one, that we're all brothers and sisters on this planet. And then you go a little bit further, and you get this sense that, all my brothers and sisters am I, that we're one and the same, that I have become my brothers and sisters. We're all one spirit. We're all one soul. I have become everyone. And then you get this feeling that I, not only am I everyone, but I created this universe. I created everybody out of my own beingness. And so this wisdom, this knowledge kind of naturally unfolds on its own until you know, prove positive conclusively who and what you are and what the universe is all about, why it was created, why we're here. All these answers are within. And I know everyone has heard that before, but not everyone has had the experience of it. And that's what we want to give people in our organization.
Tell me a little bit about why the Holy Grail, albeit many grails, why does there seem to be so much interest in it, Mark?
Because I think that there's an inner desire we all have to become immortal, to become enlightened, and to see the Christ, or to see God within the soul spirit of all of us. There is that drive to know these things, and I think that we want to know that there really is a spiritual history to this world, that it isn't just a mundane history that's built upon power and money, that there really was a history that was controlled and driven by lineages of spiritual teachers and spiritual masters, and we can still achieve that today. There's still that hope of being able to achieve these high states of consciousness, to get out of this box, to get out of this limited reality that we find ourselves in, to achieve true eternal peace and joy. And so we're driven by these desires, and the Holy Grail, the path of the Holy Grail, gives us a path through which we can do that.
Do you think we have forgotten our abilities to do this?
Yes, actually, I think we have. But the thing of it is that there's always been teachers to show us the way, just as Jesus was one of them. But so was Buddha, and so were the great mystics of the Far East. A lot of those teachers haven't been available for some time. As I said, their secret mysteries and their secret knowledge had to kind of go underground for protection, but now they're available again. Now they're pointing the path and showing, this is how you can do it. This is the way. This is the way to eternal peace and joy and happiness. And they've been coming to the U.S. for quite a while now. I would say for the last 30, 40 years, they've been making themselves available, from India, from Peru, from Egypt, from all over the world. They're coming out and saying, okay, now is the time. And so in a sense, you know, it is the time of the Holy Grail. It's the time of the masters that can show us the path of the Holy Grail, which leads to eternal life. So, yes, the Holy Grail is a symbol for this time that we're living in now.
You know, the practice of your organization, the Gnostic group that you have, also performs and practices martial arts, Tai Chi, areas like that. Why is that?
Well, what we're trying to do, George, is to make each person what we call a Gnostic warrior. And a Gnostic warrior isn't necessarily like a physical warrior that walks around with a lot of weapons and swords and spears and daggers and so forth. A Gnostic warrior is one that has the tools that can meet every challenge in his life and without any fear. And martial arts and many other things that we'll teach within the order are going to help them to live without that fear. And if you can live without that fear, you can live in spontaneity, and you can move towards that that expanded consciousness of Gnosis.
Well, that's fascinating. Well, and welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie, Mark Pinkham, our guest. Mark, tell me a little bit about Roslyn Chapel again. Let's go back. How was it established? What was its purpose?
Well, that's one of the big questions today, George, what exactly its purpose was. We know that it was a mausoleum for Sinclairs, and it's believed to be 20 Sinclairs entombed in Roslyn Chapel in full knighted armor. However, there is an interesting legend about Roslyn that says that after the Templars were in the Holy Land for 9 years digging around Solomon's temple, they left the Holy Land, and they left with five caskets or five big boxes and made their way up into Europe. Ultimately, they ended up in Scotland in Kilwinning, which is Mother Grand Lodge of Scottish Freemasonry. And there the boxes sat for a number of years until they were taken to Roslyn Castle, where the Sinclairs were living at that time. And then there was a big fire in Roslyn Castle. Those big boxes, however, were taken out just in time, saved, and just right after that, the beginning of the building of Roslyn Chapel happened. So it's believed that one of the main reasons Roslyn Chapel was built was to house those five boxes. So we know it's a mausoleum, and we know that it holds a lot of sacred relics, sacred treasures, everything from the head of John the Baptist, the Ark of the Covenant, to the Cup of Christ has been said to exist there in the crypt underneath Roslyn Chapel. And you can get a lot of things in there, George, because if you stand in Roslyn Chapel today and you look up at the roof, it's 44 feet above you. Well, Roslyn Chapel goes down just as far below. It goes down 44 feet. And that's about four stories of space that you can essentially put treasures and scrolls. So there's essentially could be a lot of things there, and actually ground scans have revealed that there is a lot of things down there.
Well, why can't they get down there to look, Mark?
Well, that's the difficulty, is because getting permission to take up the tiles of the floor is what's really the problem. The Erskines, not the Sinclair clan, are the ones that are in charge of Roslyn Chapel today, and they're not particularly interested in going underneath and getting what's in the crypt, mainly because they don't have that much invested in it. It's really the Sinclair history. It's not theirs. The Sinclairs lost the rights to Roslyn Chapel about five generations back. And
well, who owns it then, this other family?
Well, it's the Erskine clan. Peter Sinclair Erskine, he's the Earl of Roslyn today. And
what do you think it's worth if somebody were to make them an offer and just say, hey, we want to buy this place?
It's worth a ton today, George. I was just talking to Niven Sinclair. I was in the U.K. for much of the summer, and he told me, he said, boy, if I could have just bought the place a few years back, I could have got it for a drop in the bucket, but now it's going to cost millions. The reason being because of the popularity of certain Freemasonry books like the Hiram Key, and most recently, of course, it's the Da Vinci Code. So everyone's flocking there, and, of course, they're paying a top dollar to see it. And you might have heard that they filmed the Da Vinci Code and rented the place for a few days and paid £100,000, about almost $200,000 for 3 days of rent. And so it's obviously worth a lot of money right now.
So, but you're saying the Ark of the Covenant, the head of John the Baptist, maybe the Holy Grail, that those are just among the items that could be buried down there or in that chamber?
That's right. That's right. There's scrolls. It's believed there are scrolls. In fact, when they were bringing those five boxes out of the Holy Land, as they were bringing them through Europe, they stopped in Omer, which is the hometown of Geoffrey Omer. He was one of the original nine knights, and Lambert Omer. He was a priest in that town. He actually copied over one of those scrolls. And you can see that copy in one of the museums in Ghent, Belgium today. It's called the Heavenly Jerusalem, and it has all kinds of Masonic symbolism. as well as Johannite symbolism. Johannite symbolism, the Johannite heresy, basically says that there was a tradition that emanated or descended from John the Baptist and John the Apostle, and that John the Apostle was one, if not the true successor to Jesus. So you see this symbology all throughout this copy. Well, the writers of the Hiram Key believe that some of the scrolls were seen scrolls. That the Templars took out of the Holy Land, and they did pick a lot of Masonic rites that eventually became part of Freemasonry today.
Or who knows what other things are in those scrolls, because as we well know, the Essenes wrote the Dead Sea Scrolls. What if this is just a continuation of those scrolls?
That could be absolutely right. Some people think it's the scrolls that confirm the marriage between Jesus and Mary. Some of the scrolls confirm the Holy Grail lineage, the Johannite lineage the Templars were initiated into, that emanated from John the Baptist and John the Apostle. So it could be all kinds of scrolls. And it's actually conclusive that there was a black Madonna. Or is a black Madonna down there, because the original altar had a big black Madonna in it. You see, Roslyn Chapel was built to, one reason it was built is to be a monument to the goddess and the goddess tradition. And Gnosticism comes out of the goddess tradition, which is one reason that our order is very connected to Roslyn Chapel and the Sinclairs. The Sinclairs, right from the beginning, have been the preservers of the Gnostic tradition.
But I'll tell you what I don't understand, though, Mark. If I owned a place like this family owns Roslyn Chapel, and if I knew that there was a possible chamber underneath that would be easy to have some access to, and you could get in there with the right kind of equipment that could have some of the greatest mysteries of mankind, I'd be down there in a heartbeat. I don't understand why they're holding back. There's got to be another reason here.
Well, you could be absolutely right. The Sinclairs I've talked to think that it's just not in the interest of Peter Sinclair Erskine to do it. However, he could be being influenced by some silent partners or perhaps the church itself, knowing that what is down there could have a very detrimental effect on them. Certainly.
So I was going to say, what do you think the ramifications are if the Ark of the Covenant is there, the head of John the Baptist, some of the Essene scrolls? Well, I mean, what's the downside then?
Well, it has the effect of blowing the roof off the Catholic Church, but we think that that's inevitable anyway. We believe, according to the prophecy of Malachi.
How would it do that, though? How would it blow the lid off the Catholic
Church? Well, first of all, if there's Johannite scrolls that confirm the Johannite lineage, it would say, one, that John the Apostle and not St. Peter was the true successor of Jesus. And second, it would say that Jesus is part of a very long lineage of masters who were all great enlightened beings. He wasn't the one only Son of God, but he was one of many. And so think about the effect that would have on Christian ideology.
Well, maybe they just have to adjust and change it a little bit.
Well, that's it. We're hoping there's not going to be a huge mass hysteria when this information comes out, which we think it will eventually, which is why one reason that we are forming the International Order of Gnostic Templars, because we want to show people that Jesus was a great master, no question, and he can be a savior if you choose him as such. But he was not the only one and only. He was part of a very long lineage of masters that goes all the way back to Sri Lanka, and it's this lineage that unites East and West together. And that's what we believe was the original goal of the Templars, was to unite East and West forms of spirituality, and they weren't able to complete that goal. So one reason we have formed is to complete that goal of the Templars.
I guess you can't force someone, if this is private property, you can't force them to open up these chambers, can you?
No, absolutely not. And there's also, you have to get permission from Historical Scotland, who are in control of all these ancient monuments, and that's extremely difficult as well. But it wasn't that long ago, 4 or 5 years ago, that that panel was taken up off the floor, and there was an excavation that occurred under the guidance of Andrew Sinclair, and they dug down through a lot of sand. Actually, what they found is that the crypt is backfilled by hundreds of tons of sand. It looks as though this could be for the purpose of preserving what's ever down there. But so Andrew and whoever was involved with that excavation, they found some things. They found a wooden chalice, for example, which actually would have been closer to the vessel that Jesus would have had at the Last Supper than a lot of them Holy Grails that are out there today. But they also found apparently a couple skulls, human skulls, and we know that the Templars were very much involved with using skulls in their worship. And these skulls had trepanation holes over where both sides of the head, where if a human had horns, this is where they would be.
Horns? You mean like devilish horns?
Well, yeah. But what's interesting is that if you go into Roslyn Chapel today, it's full of heads of the Green Man, and the Green Man is the Lord of Nature, who sometimes depicted as a horned deity or a horned god. So perhaps these human skulls were actually drilled to represent this Green Man, this horned god, which does appear to be a deity, have been a deity of the Templars, because that's actually a natural deity of Gnostics, is to open their eyes to nature, to see God everywhere, to see the deity of nature, who is the Green Man, who is the original son of the goddess, you see.
What if these are the skulls of the fallen angels that were depicted in the Bible, in Genesis, you know, and maybe they were, you know, like Satan, for example, Luciferians?
Well, that whole ideology is actually one that was built up by through the patriarchal fundamentalist traditions. It's not something that you find in the ancient goddess tradition. In that tradition, you find Gnostics opening their eyes to nature and seeing the spirit of nature, which they referred to as the son of the goddess. He was Dionysus. He was Mordegian. He was Osiris, and he was the deity that they went out and danced with in the wilderness, in the woods. And this is apparently what was happening around Roslyn Chapel, because gypsies used to come there all the time. The gypsies were actually protected by the Sinclairs, and they would camp out right around Roslyn Chapel, and they would be convorting with the Green Man all summer as they were doing this. And so their worship seems to have rubbed off a bit on the Sinclairs, but the Sinclairs were already Gnostics themselves, so they were very familiar with the Green Man. But this is an experience that you can have commonly in the goddess tradition. But what's happened over time is that leaders of the patriarchal tradition have decided that this spirit of nature, lord of nature, this son of the goddess, is the devil himself. But what you find is they're normally not people that have had direct experience of this being. And 9 times out of 10, they are relying on what others have told them about this being. Right?
Well, I got to tell you, though, Mark, if they've got horned skulls down there of half human or half whatever, I mean, that is an incredible find, both for religion and for science.
Right. Well, I didn't say necessarily that they had horns, George. I said that they had trepanation horns. That means there was holes drilled where horns would have been if we did have horns, you see.
Yeah, but I mean, what if they were trying to, hide those horns that were there or do whatever they had to do? Isn't it weird to drill in that spot?
Yes and no. If you travel around the world and go into different museums, for example, in Egypt and Peru, you can see a lot of skulls that have trepanation holes in them. And it's more common to find the holes around the third eye, but you can find them in other parts of the head. And these holes were drilled so that whoever owned that skull could have more of a Gnostic vision. They could activate certain psychic centers within the brain so that they could Establish themselves in Gnostic consciousness. So it's actually pretty common around the world.
Do any countries, any major groups seem to have any interest at all in what could be in that crypt?
Oh, I think that everybody does. I think everyone's waiting around to see what's going to be there. Certainly the Scottish people have a lot of vested interest. They believe that some of the Scottish crown jewels are in there. The Holy Rood, which is a piece of the original cross that was brought to Scotland during the time of Malcolm Canmore, that could be there. Certainly those that are involved with the Essene movement, those that are interested in the idea of Jesus and Mary having married and creating a lineage between them. I think that absolutely is very many. Certainly the Johannite tradition today, there is a Johannite church that says it's descended from John the Apostle. And there could be scrolls that do say, that do talk about that lineage, that it came from John the Baptist, John the Apostle, and down a lineage of John's, and then it was inherited by the Templars and then taken into Europe with them.
Is this a mystical place, Mark? I mean, when you're in there, do you feel strange or any kind of powers like that?
Well, it depends when you go, I think. If you're going in the middle of the day and in the middle of summer, you're not as liable to experience as much as if you went in the middle of winter when not many people are there. However, there have been people that have gone in there that are very mystically oriented. For example, there was someone that was actually the archivist for the Dalai Lama. He went in there, he visited Roslyn Chapel, and he came out and he says, "Wow, this is an amazing place. I've had a truly magnificent spiritual experience here." And soon after that, there was a feng shui master that went in there and did all kinds of measurements. And he said, "This is Roslyn's one of the most powerful sites he's ever visited. He's ever done any measurements on in the whole entire world, and he sees it as being the a great center of peace for the new era." So, yes, to answer your question, there is a lot of power, a lot of energy there, and that was the idea behind making it. It's kind of a small Gothic cathedral, and my belief, after being in a lot of Gothic cathedrals, is that they were all designed to generate this power of the Holy Spirit, this alchemical power of the Holy Grail, that when you are surrounded by that power, that the process of alchemical transformation goes on naturally within you. And the Sinclairs refer to Roslyn Chapel as the Holy Grail of their family, of their clan.
Your website, of course, GnosticTemplars.org. The book, Guardians of the Holy Grail, where can people obtain that, Mark?
Certainly Amazon.com. They can order it, or they can order it through us, 800-231-9811. They can order it. Just give us a call, or you can order it online. Go to going to our website, GnosticTemplars.org.
All right, Mark. When we come back next hour, let's talk a little bit about alchemy. What were they really trying to concoct anyway? I'm George Norrie, Mark Pinkamargus. Mark, let's talk about alchemy for a moment, because you have studied it. Again, the original purpose for alchemy was what? What did they want to do?
The original purpose for alchemy, George, is simply to create this energy of the Holy Grail, this energy that initiates a process of transformation within the human body. This is how it all began. And so to do that, there was originally there were many practices that you could do, but ultimately what they would do, these practices would do, would unite the male and the female energies together. The polarity comes together. And I've actually practiced and studied many of these techniques in India. We know that the Templars were involved with some of these practices that they learned through the Sufis, who had in turn learned them from India, but also a lot came up from Kemet, which is the ancient name for Egypt. And that's basically what it's all about, is uniting the polarity together. For example, there are places in the body that are associated with fire. There's places in the body associated with water, so you want to unite the water and the fire. There's In both sexes, there are both male and female hormones. You try to unite those together. Of course, another way is simply uniting the sexes together. That's sexual tantra, uniting the polarity that way. You can also make the physical pill of immortality, or the philosopher's stone, if you will, which is what the alchemists of Europe were trying to do by uniting substances that were associated with the male-female with those associated with the female principle and calling them philosophical mercury and philosophical sulfur. And by uniting them together in just the right way, it would create a red stone, a very fiery red stone, which kind of simulated the energy of the kundalini power that exists within the human body that does the work of transformation when it's activated.
When I was in school, Mark, they used to tell us that the alchemists wanted to make gold.
That's right, yeah. But that's kind of a lower degenerated version of alchemy. Originally, the alchemy was uniting the polarity within the body and awakening that energy of kundalini. Later on, it became to create the philosopher's stone so that essentially you're creating that energy outside the physical body, and then you would kind of crumble that philosopher's stone up, that red stone, and then you would spread it, dust a metal like lead, and then it would transform into a gold. But originally, if you study alchemy, they say that the true alchemy is creating that energy, that alchemical energy within the human body.
Coast to Coast guest Lawrence Gardner says that part of the effort of the alchemist was to create a white powder of gold, which would allow them to do incredible things. Have you ever heard of that?
Oh, yes. I've studied all kinds of different forms of alchemy, and certainly that is one of them. And apparently they found that white powder in certain of the temples in Egypt, Mount Sinai, different places such as that. It's a valid approach, and I've actually used the white powder gold myself. However, I haven't gotten very dramatic results from it, and I wouldn't necessarily prescribe it for other people because there as far as I know there aren't any real masters on the planet today who have actually gone the whole route of alchemy by taking that white powder gold. So it's actually a little bit dangerous at this point.
Okay, now earlier you were telling me about the martial arts that were important for this. Tell me about that.
Okay, well, the martial arts, one thing is going to break down a person's fear so that they can be a true warrior, a true Gnostic warrior, and live without fear. To develop true Gnosticism, you have to go beyond the fear. That's one thing that keeps us from being in that Gnostic state. It's the fear that keeps our mind generating all these thoughts, and all these thoughts that keep our mind from being totally free. You need a clear mind, what they call in Zen the no mind, before that Gnostic consciousness can really take root. But another reason for these martial arts is so that everybody can learn to move in harmony with the life force. Most of the martial arts started with Tai Chi, which was created by masters in the Far East who knew how to move their body totally in harmony with the life force. And the life force moves in kind of a circular, spiral way. And most of these moves in Tai Chi, you'll find, move in a circular way. Now, if you practice Tai Chi every day, not only will you learn how to move in harmony with the life force physically, but you'll find that everything else in your life becomes more balanced as well. Your job, your relationships, everything. And so thus, by studying these martial arts, you're able to master not only the physical body, but also many other aspects, other areas of your life.
Do most religions recommend that? I don't think so. I've never heard of that before.
Well, I think that in... I think that religion is, when I think of religion, I think of kind of entry level, where people are just kind of getting their feet wet on spirituality, mm-hmm. and when they're ready to move on, they move on to these other practices. And I think that when they are ready, they move on to practices such as yoga, such as meditation, such as Tai Chi, where they are working physically to purify their bodies. So I think that you'll find that if you go deeper into spirituality and you study these paths that people embark on when they're really seriously ready to totally commit their lives to a spiritual path.
Does your Gnostic teachings say or react at all to life beyond this planet, extraterrestrial visitation, anything like that, Mark?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Just like the Freemasons in their lodges, they defer to the blazing star over their altars, which represents the star Sirius. So do we, because of course we became the Freemasons, and in our tradition we believe that a lot of our rites actually came through missionaries from the star Sirius. A lot of the alchemical rites. Also, we believe that the Templars were initiated into the Holy Grail lineage that started in the Far East, and that actually started with the Sons of God, which the Theosophists in the Far East have found came from Venus. So, absolutely, and actually, I myself and others in the tradition have felt a special relationship to Sirius and Venus, and it appears as though a lot of the alchemical traditions on the planet today came from those two points, those two stars. And in Theosophy, at one point, people like Alice Bailey were doing a lot of channeling from extraterrestrials, and they found out, for example, that the Sirians, or Sirius is known as the Great White Lodge, and the Sirians actually did bring the first three levels of Freemasonry to this planet, of entered apprentice, fellow craft, and master mason. And so, you know, we can't say conclusively that this is true, but it's something that we're looking into and exploring.
You've heard of the Dogon tribe?
Their connection to Sirius. So, and because of the Dogon and tribes such as that, we're more convinced that, yes, the Sirians did indeed traveled to this planet as missionaries at some time in the past, and also there's the story of the Chintamani stone and Nicholas Roark, how the Chintamani stone came from Sirius, was brought here by missionaries, and it was in the possession of the League of Nations originally, and then after the League of Nations collapsed, it was taken back to the Far East and in Shambhala by Nicholas Roark. So there's a lot of those references to Sirius and Venus in the esoteric literature.
Well, Mark, you know, that fascinates me a lot because there are different types of practices that have talked about visitations in the past. And one has to assume after a while, if you hear it from five or six different kinds of organizations, groups, what have you, something happened here thousands of years ago. You got to believe that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'm also trained as a shaman in a Peruvian tradition that uses a kind of a cactus called the San Pedro Huachuma, and for thousands of years the shamans down there have been seeing into other realms and other dimensions and having interdimensional experience, and they actually say that cactus came from Venus originally, and when you're under the influence that you can often have visitations or experiences of the Venusians, and the teacher that I studied with has had a number of them. He was even taken aboard a Venusian craft at one point. But one of the main things I find on any kind of San Pedro experience is that people, if they do it at night, they look up at the star Venus, and there's always some kind of special gift or some kind of special energy or light that emanates from that star and comes right to them. So it does definitely seem to be some special connection there.
What was the name of that cactus again?
Well, it's San Pedro, of course, it's St. Peter, or Huachuma. Huachuma is a more ancient Inca name for it. And of course, San Pedro is the Spanish name. When the Spanish conquistador showed up, that's what they named it.
If you do a Google search for San Pedro cactus, would it come up like that?
Yes, it probably would, yeah, absolutely.
And what do you do, eat it or drink it?
Well, it's actually made into a liquid, a drink, and you drink it. It gives you visions. It's the old shamanic path all over the world. The shamans were were involved with taking some kind of sacrament like that. And
it won't hurt you?
No, no, not at all. But you have to take it under the guidance of a shaman.
Like ayahuasca, right?
It's somewhat similar. I think ayahuasca is definitely a lot more intense, and you're a lot more liable to vomit or have a negative physical reaction than you are with Wachuma.
Now, why do you need a shaman there with you?
Just because he knows
exact
dose, and if there is any kind of negative reactions you have, the shaman knows what to do about it,
That's a good point, how to take you out of it.
Exactly, right.
Some of the things that you write about in the curriculum of the order, the Arthurian tarot, is that for the tarot cards?
Yeah, absolutely. The tarot has within it many of the mysteries of the universe, and the tarot we really believe comes out of the Holy Grail tradition. You find in the minor arcana the different suits. The four suits correspond to the four different manifestations of the Holy Grail, with the sword and the spear and the stone or the rock and the chalice. And we believe that if you do a study of the major and minor arcana, you can get an understanding of the true Holy Grail lineage and the whole path of alchemical transformation.
Do you also believe in the Bible has the Book of Revelation, end times?
Oh, absolutely.
You do?
Okay. I believe in that. But, of course, there's many different interpretations you can come up with by studying that.
Sure.
And I don't know that there's just one. And I think that it kind of speaks to everybody differently, you know. But St. John the Apostle is a very important figure in our tradition. He's a patron of our tradition. He's the grandmaster of this Holy Grail lineage that the Templars were initiated into in the Holy Land, and he's really one of the original fathers of Gnosticism in the West, and so it was the revelation of St. John, as well as the Gospel of St. John, which were the principal scriptures of most all of the Gnostic sects in ancient times, and they're some of our principal texts as well.
Of everything you've studied, Mark, everything that's out there, is there one aspect that has fascinated you more than anything?
Yeah, I would say probably the Kundalini. Just to see the manifestations of Kundalini, to feel that energy when you sit down to meditate and you repeat a few mantras and you feel it's kind of emerged out of the base of your spine, and the next thing you know, you're flying, you're astral traveling through the universe, or you're on some astral planet, or you're having this intense vision, or you're bouncing up and down like a rubber ball. It's just, it's really rather phenomenal to see this and to experience it. So I think of everything I've undergone, I would have to say that ranks up at the top of the list.
Well, I got to tell you, this is fascinating talking with you about this, Mark, because it echoes so many things that a lot of people have studied. How close is this to the Rosicrucians and what they believe in?
Well, it's very close, because the Rosicrucians, they were all alchemists. And if you study the legend of Christian Rosicrucius, even though that's kind of a metaphor for the origination of the order, it talks about Christian Rosicrucius going and studying alchemy in Damkar, Damascus, and in Fez among the Sufis. So they were very much involved with creating the alchemical substance, the alchemical power of transformation. And they were actually known as fire philosophers because of that, because they were interested in creating that fire, that inner fire. And, the symbol of the Rosicrucians is a cross with a rose on it. Well, the rose in ancient times was the symbol of Venus, and Venus was known as the star of alchemy, or the patroness of all alchemy. So it aligns them with this very ancient Venusian tradition that we ourselves are aligned with. And so there's a very close connection, actually, with the Rosicrucians and the Templars. And in fact, the Templars at one point were known as the Knights of the Rose Cross.
Tell me about Merlin. You ever stumble across him in any of your works and readings?
Absolutely, yeah. It appears as though there was definitely more than one Merlin, I think. And it appears as though it could have been an office of magicians that were actually served some of the ancient Irish and Scottish kings, because there's actually many names for them, and supposedly they did many different things. Certainly, I think that they were very incredible masters. Of course, the Legend of Merlin is that he was fathered by the Dragon of Destruction, which means that he had the power. He had this Kundalini power. He had the command of it, and it's this Kundalini power through which that one can create universes. It can do great magic, and this is why in ancient times it was always important to go through a long process of apprenticeship with a master, Kundalini master, before that energy was awakened within you, because if it was awakened and you're not ready, then you would use that power for your own purposes, and it could bring the destruction to you and much of the planet, for that matter.
Was Merlin a good guy? One of the good people?
It appears as though from his legend, yes, he definitely was. He used that power in a very positive, uplifting, beneficial way. I think that he did have a human side in the stories, and he had to suffer for that. But I would say in general that definitely he was one of the good guys. I would probably say that he was probably descended from the Tuatha De Danann people, ultimately, who were great masters. They were the first masters, first alchemical masters and Kundalini masters up there in Great Britain, and they were the people of Dana Danu, which is the name of the goddess, and these Danus or Danans once covered much of the planet, and you've got the Danavas in India, the tribe of Dan, and they were all associated with the serpent and with magic, and they had great magical powers.
Okay, well, you stay with us. Mark, have the Knights Templars of today have direct knowledge of the ancient Templars and some of their specifics, or have we lost that in the years and years and years?
I would definitely say we've lost it, and this is one reason that we formed the IOGT, is to revive that ancient wisdom. What happened was early 1800s, there was a man named Bernard Fabre Palipart who was involved with reviving the Templar tradition in France, and he especially revived the Gnostic rites and the Gnostic ideology. And this continued until mid-1800s when there was a split within the order, so that the kind of the Gnostic rites and Gnostic practices went their own way and became the Johannite Church today. And then the Templar order at that point simply became more of a military order, more of a charitable organization. And today it's usually known as the SMOTJ, the Sovereign Military Order of the Temple of Jerusalem. And its membership is mostly active or retired military. You also have, though, in the York Rite of Freemasonry, the last degree is the degree of the Knights Templar. And they actually perform some of the ancient rites that the Templars themselves once did, such as originally they drank out of a skull, and the Templars used a lot of skull as part of their Gnostic rites. But I don't think you're going to find that a lot of people in the York Rite really understand what this is all about. And so even though they might be practicing some of the ancient rites, they've really lost the interpretation or the understanding of them. And this is what we're trying to bring back.
Dana from Chico, California, wants to know if you ever did any research into Fulcanelli and his book, The Mysteries of the Cathedrals.
I have come across that book at times, and how it refers to the the goddess tradition and the activation of that energy, that Holy Spirit energy, using sacred principles and sacred geometry in the construction of these cathedrals. And we know that the Templars actually trained many of the Masons. And many of the Masons were actually Templars themselves, because there was three levels of Templars. There was the sergeants, the knights and then the chaplains, and one division of the sergeants were to be Masons. And so Templars themselves were Masons, and they created a lot of these Gothic cathedrals to generate that alchemical power. And a lot of that wisdom they learned from the Sufis. The Gothic arch actually came from the Sufis, and it's known that the Templars studied directly from the Al-Banna, which is a division of Sufis, which is dedicated to building and sacred geometry.
Matthew from Indiana wants to know if you ever saw the movie National Treasure, and if so, if that was an accurate portrayal of some of the things the Knights Templar did.
Yes, I did see that movie. I thought it was well done. However, I don't, from what I've come across, I haven't found that it's completely in alignment with what did happen to the Templar treasure. At this point, it does look as though if it's any place, it's in Roslyn Chapel or maybe one of the Gothic cathedrals in Europe, like Chartres Cathedral, or perhaps it could be one of the preceptories or the commanderies or the fortresses built by the Templars somewhere in Europe or the Middle East. And at one point they say there was 800 of those. So they were all over the place. And so I don't think that those treasures necessarily made it over here. I think there's a much better chance that they're still over in Europe or the Middle East.
Sandra from Florida wants to know what you think might be in the Ark of the Covenant.
Might be in the Ark of the Covenant?
Yes.
Well, I don't disagree with historians who say that the probably the tablets, the stone tablets of Moses. I think that there's definitely some secret scriptures, some secret scrolls there, and I think that they do date back to the time of Egypt, and that they were scrolls related to the alchemical traditions of the Osirian priesthood of Egypt. I think that's probably definitely true.
Someone wants to know anonymously, of course, if you could describe how the Roslyn Chapel physically looks.
Well, I think that, there's actually a image of it on my website, GnosticTemplars.org. It looks like a small Gothic cathedral, if you know what that looks like. There's a 14 flying buttresses, 7 on either side of it, which was a special feature of all Gothic architecture. So if you can think of a small version of a Gothic cathedral, basically that's what you've got. Yeah.
Joshua from Monroe, Michigan wants to know if you've heard of Benjamin Krem or the Maitreya.
I'm familiar with that whole sect or that whole movement. I've seen pictures of this person claiming to be Maitreya. I've seen pictures, films, whatever. I don't really connect with him. I don't have the feeling that he's exactly what he says that he is, and I'm kind of going by my own intuition there, and which more and more I'm trying to depend upon. I think that if he really was the Maitreya, to bring in the New Age as the Templar, the Tibetans predict, that he would have a lot more of a Tibetan following than he seems to.
Sonia from Florida wants to know if you think the Templars might be connected to the ancient Atlanteans.
Well, certainly. I mean, a lot of wisdom, a lot of knowledge came from Atlantis. Obviously, there's not a direct link, but it looks as though the missionaries from Atlantis came up through Egypt, as an example, and established the lodges and the sects of alchemists in Egypt. Of course, the Nazis believe that the Atlanteans ended up in somewhere in the Far East, and they came west from there and brought their traditions. I think that also there were some traditions, perhaps, that were brought directly to the Middle East from Atlantis. For example, there are some huge megalithic sites there in the Middle East, which are said to have been built there by the sons of God, who could have been the Atlanteans. Also, there's a tradition of the Sons of God landing on Mount Hermon and descending from there and establishing a lineage of giants that were eventually wiped out by the Hebrews under Jeremiah. And also on Hebron, which was the first place where the Jewish kings built their castle, there was a worship of the Kabiri twins. And the Kabiri were known as those of fire, those of the alchemy. And it's believed that the Kabiri twins were originally worshipped on Atlantis. So that could have been a direct Atlantean cult that came to the Middle East, and certainly the Templars could have learned of it when they were there.
Nathan from Oregon wants to know if the San Pedro cactus is prohibited in the United States. Any drug laws, anything like that?
Actually, that's one of the few that isn't, and we'd like to keep it that way. And one way we're going to do that is so that it isn't frivolously used. It's used under the guidance of a shaman. What generally tends to happen is people don't understand these sacraments, and they don't take them under the guidance of someone who does understand them. They take too much, they OD, and then they become illegal. So as long as we can consume these plants that are legal with great respect and under the guidance of shaman, then I think that we're going to be okay. But I'd hate to see that and whatever plants are left over, like salvia divinorum, become illegal simply because we misuse it.
So you obviously don't recommend people grow their own cactus.
I don't unless they're willing to go through some training to understand how to prepare it and the right dosage for them.
Margot from Los Angeles wants to know how you can join the International Order of Gnostic Templars.
Well, I welcome that question. One reason is because we're having an initiation ceremony coming up in December. It'll be the first one in the States. We're going to try to bring our international grand prior, Ian Sinclair, over for the event. It's going to be here in Sedona. And how you would apply for it, register for it, you can go onto our Gnostic Templar website and click on initiation to the IOGT. It gives you instructions as to what to do. We're trying to set it up right now so that you, once you get to the initiation page, you can just click on a word or click on something that will actually bring up an application form, and you can directly download it from there. But that is an excellent question, and we welcome all people who are interested in our organization, because we feel that we're right now on the threshold in this world of a new planetary spirituality of uniting East and West, and we want everybody to come together, join with us in that quest, in that goal, in that work. And we feel like we've got the link. We have at least one link, which is the Holy Grail lineage that started in Sri Lanka, came west with the Mandaeans, merged with the Nazarene Essenes, and gave birth to John the Baptist and Jesus and John the Apostle, and then was adopted by the Templars. So we welcome everybody to come together to do this work with us. But it isn't just, a planetary work we're doing together. It's also work on ourselves, certainly, and to achieve that level of gnosis. And this is one reason that one of our headquarters is in Sedona, because this is certainly the land of initiation. It has been for thousands of years among the Native Americans. They would come here to get in touch with their gnosis, to come to an understanding of the universe, and also to create lines of communication with their higher self. So they come on vision quests and get answers. And so this is why we were directed to make our headquarters here, is because it promotes the Gnostic experience to everyone who comes here.
Can people keep their own religions and practice that and still be a member of the IOGT?
Oh, absolutely. We would never say that you need to discard your religion. We're just here to enhance whatever you're doing and perhaps try to take you further on your spiritual path. We would never say discard what you have been practicing unless you're ready to do that. That's the only way.
Stephanie from Washington, state of, wants to know a little bit more about the John the Baptist connection with the Templars.
Well, that's also a very, very excellent question. There's a lot to that answer, because, as I mentioned, the Templars were initiated into a Holy Grail lineage that came from Sri Lanka. And you find out the origins of this lineage through the Mandaeans. The Mandaeans are really the only surviving Gnostic sect on the planet today, and they're in southern Iraq. According to their traditions, this lineage started in the Garden of Eden, which today, you know, a third of the world says is Sri Lanka. And then it came west. The Mandaeans came west with their masters. They were great masters of the Mandaean tradition, known as the Nasserai. And with the Nasserai, the Mandaeans merged with the Egyptian culture, then the Persian, and then the Essenes. And then they gave rise to the Essene sect known as the Nasserai, the Nazarenes. And John the Baptist was born into that sect, and he became actually the last prophet of the Mandaeans. And John the Baptist, of course, his focus was baptizing people in the River Jordan, and the focus of Mandaean spirituality is baptism, but with a different consciousness than we baptize today. For one thing, the baptism has to be in flowing water, and a Mandaean priest will actually activate an alchemical energy to flow within that water through certain mantras and certain prayers. So anyway, John the Baptist was the founder of the Gnostic tradition and the Holy Grail lineage in the West, and it's believed that he was actually he actually incarnated the energy of the first grandmaster that started the whole lineage in Sri Lanka, who today is worshipped in temples there, and he's known as Murugan or Sanat Kumara or Kartikeya. He's actually the very first Kundalini master that ever lived on this planet. This is how the Hindus know him. And he was full of this Kundalini power. In fact, he was one with it. And so this is why I think they say that John the Baptist incarnated him or his power, because John the Baptist was full of the Holy Spirit from birth. He was full of that Kundalini power, that Kundalini energy. And if you go to the Middle East today, the Sufis say, yes, John the Baptist, he was an incarnation of Elijah, the prophet Elijah. Well, they also say that Elijah is another name for Al-Qadir, who was a Sufi green man, and Al-Qadir is another name for this Sanat Kumara, this master from Sri Lanka. So by a circuitous route, John the Baptist will take you all the way back to this original Holy Grail master called Sanat Kumara Kartikeya.
The fact that the head of John the Baptist, the skull, might be at the Roslyn Chapel, what is the purpose of keeping the skull? You know, what is it supposed to do?
Well, that's a really good question, too. It's believed that the Templars found the head of John the Baptist during the Fourth Crusade when they entered one of the big palaces there, and there was a chapel attached to that palace that had these incredible, valuable relics. It had the Holy Shroud, for example. It had pieces of the original cross, and it also had the head of John the Baptist. Well, it's believed that the Templars took that head back into Europe, and they started using it. They were placing it on their highest altars, and this is the Baphomet, the head of wisdom that they were alleged to have worshipped. When the Templars went before the Inquisition, they actually said that there was incredible power that emanated from that head, and it could actually make trees blossom or grass grow. It had that kind of power associated with it. So it appears as though the head of John the Baptist was still full of that Holy Grail power, that Holy Spirit that John was full of when he was born. And so simply by being in proximity to it, it would have an alchemical effect on you. It was essentially, and I believe, probably the most valuable of all the Holy Grail manifestations that the Templars ever had in their possession. And it's known that they did have the Cup of Christ at one point or another. And one reason that this was the most valuable Holy Grail manifestation is because the Templars knew that they were part of this Holy Grail lineage. It started with John the Baptist. And even though Jesus to them was a great being, a great master, they usually gave their allegiance to John the Baptist and considered him their savior because he actually preceded Jesus. He was the original master and came before Jesus. He was the teacher of Jesus. And this is why they worshiped the Baphomet head and called it their great savior. And it's also said that they denounced their affiliation with Jesus and put their affiliation solely with Baphomet or John the Baptist.
If you could ask John the Baptist one question, if you could go back into time, what might that be, Mark?
I would have to say that tell me your lineage. I have studied the Holy Grail lineage, and I believe I understand it, but I'm not totally sure. So, you know, confirm what I do know.
Okay, stay with us. Back in the cave in St. Louis, but soon enough, back in Los Angeles, the City of Angels. Mark Pinkham, our guest, with your phone calls as well. Give us a definition, if you can, Mark, for Gnostic, if you could.
Gnostic. I would say that a Gnostic is one who goes inside himself or herself to uncover the wisdom that exists within their own soul, within their own heart. They do that by following certain paths of yoga, of alchemy, awakening this transformative essence of kundalini. All these things will go to transform them so that they can get in touch with that knowledge, that wisdom. It's in the East, it's believed that we're all like mirrors covered over with dust, and we simply need to clear away the dust, i.e., in our case, the toxins and the limited concepts that we all hold, before we can uncover the pure, sparkling spirit underneath that will reveal to us our true nature and the nature of the universe. A Gnostic is someone just like John the Baptist who goes into the woods, lives in the wood, without any books, without anything at all other than himself, and has a direct personal experience of the divine, of his own true nature, without the intercession of any kind of priest, any kind of book, any kind of doctrine whatsoever. And this is the kind of experience that we want to give everybody in our organization.
Do you believe there is a divine creator?
Well, certainly. It certainly makes sense that there was some kind of intelligence. Certainly there was a divine mind that filtered down or shall we say contracted down to create the geometrical formations that exist in the world today. I tend to subscribe to the Eastern philosophy that at the beginning of time all there was pure consciousness, and that a divine mind, a divine creator, emerged out of that pure consciousness, which they refer to often as the goddess herself, who was pure life force. And as she contracted, she became all the forms of the physical universe. So essentially, this is all her, and she's the divine mind, the divine consciousness of this transcendental spirit, which in the East they refer to as Shiva. You could also say that she's the original serpent and the original dragoness that all the ancient cultures used to worship as the creatress. And one reason they worshipped her as a serpent is because the life force, which she is, moves in spirals just like a snake or a serpent. In my philosophy or my school of thought, she is the true creator of the universe, is the goddess herself.
To the phones we go. Wild Card Line, welcome to Coast to Coast. And where are you calling from?
This is Pete. I'm calling from the middle of the desert. I'm a truck driver out here on I-10 in California.
Hawk the horn there, Peter.
Air pretty good out here. It's nice and quiet.
Okay, go ahead.
Yes, my question is that he said that they removed 5 crates from Solomon's temple. I was wondering how was that possible when Solomon's temple was destroyed by the Babylonians and Nebuchadnezzar back 500 years before the Messiah walked the earth.
That's a good question. Actually, It wasn't, they didn't go inside Solomon's Temple. Of course, it didn't exist, but they actually dug around the foundations of Solomon's Temple. And these foundations were inside of what's known as Solomon's stables. King Baldwin II gave the Templars the Al-Aqsa Mosque on the Temple Mount to live in, and just below that was Solomon's stables. And so they spent a lot of time in there digging around. Apparently, that's where the foundations of Solomon's Temple were. And so that's where they did their digging and got these scrolls and treasures that they took out of the Holy Land.
Okay, thank you. George, you're doing a great job.
Thank you, Pete. Appreciate it. Drive carefully. Next up, first-time caller line. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hello there.
Hi.
This is Margie from Reading, Pennsylvania.
Hey, Margie, go ahead.
I can't tell you. This is the first time I ever called your show. I'm an older lady. You know, I'm 67.
Ah, that's not old, Margie.
Okay, that's what that guy said that I was talking to. Well, anyway, 15 years ago, I had an experience. And I was walking along the woods, and my grandson was very ill. He was only 3 years old. We thought we were going to lose him. And my heart was breaking. And I took my fist, and I looked up to heaven, and I said, if you're really there and you really exist, you'll let me die so my grandson can live. And boom, just like he said, I fell to the ground. I felt like I looped around the universe. Like I flew back into myself, and I know, you know, it was all going on in my mind, but I was on the ground, and when I stood up, I said these words, and I never said anything like this before in my life. I was asleep, and you awakened me. You took me to a crystal room, and you laid me down upon the satin sheets. When you gazed at my nakedness, artesian wells of passion sprang forth from you, me, and you kissed me where I was cold with your warm lips. I said, why am I saying this? All of a sudden, I felt like the right and my left side of the brain got married. That's the, I mean, I know, like I was sleeping, like inside of me was a sleeping spirit. And this joining, this marriage awakened me, and I like knew stuff that I didn't know how I could possibly know. What do I know? You know, I didn't know anything about like the Great White Brotherhood or the Knights of Tech, but yet all this knowledge was there. It turned me into a poet, and I spent my life writing. I write books, but the money goes to for charity, like for cancer, for juvenile diabetes, and so forth. But he is exactly right. Everything he said is true. There's something within us sleeping, and when it connects, when whatever happens, this marriage or this right left side of the brain, this collective unconsciousness is aware of itself, and when you're aware of yourself, you're aware of the divinity of everything you look at.
Now, here's somebody there, Mark, who's definitely tuned in.
Absolutely.
Wouldn't you think?
Absolutely. What she is talking about is exactly what we've been covering tonight. For example, the uniting of the left and right hemispheres of the brain, that's pure alchemy. And that's what we try to do to get in touch with that Gnosticism within ourselves. And that happened just spontaneously and naturally within this woman, and getting in touch with this poetry within, that's very, very natural. I've been among a number of masters, Kundalini masters in the East, and when you hang out with them, it's like all of a sudden they break into song or they break into poetry. It's like it's the only way that they can really describe this incredible experience that they're having within themselves. It's and still they're not able to completely communicate it, and which is why that they encourage you to get on the path of Gnosticism. My Kundalini master teachers were like that. They'd always, you know, break into song or they'd break into poetry and to connect with this Gnosticism. And Gopi Krishna, who's famous for what he went through on the Kundalini path, that's where it led him. he just found himself, you know, naturally just breaking into song, just breaking into poetry. And that's the experience that I've had as well. It's a really amazing experience. And those words, they just seem to come out of nowhere. It's like you're really connecting to your source, your essence, which is that spirit, which is your guidance. And it's an amazing experience. So I really appreciate that. I appreciate you sharing that experience with us tonight.
All right, let's go to our international line. Where are you calling from? Hi there.
Yes, this is Joseph. I'm calling from Haifa, Israel.
Hello, Joseph. Thank you for calling. Go ahead.
Hi, and good morning, George. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning.
I was just wondering about a more practical application, maybe from a scientific point of view, such as I've viewed Kundalini levitation attempts, and they seem to me to be, slightly farcical, but I could be misinterpreting what I'm seeing. But these were people that were sitting in a somewhat typical position in an ordinary sitting down when you're,
meditating.
Meditating, thank you. And they were able to launch themselves about 2 to 3 feet forward, and then they would smile, and they'd say, well, we just levitated. And I'm wondering about the crossover of the scientific application, because what you have to say is very interesting, but I think it falls more, a little bit more towards the, what would you call, the writings of some of the old writings. It falls more towards mystical writings and so forth, but I don't see the crossover for a scientific application that has emerged in the scientific community. So it can use some of these advanced thinking modalities or something that can cross over and help the scientific community, help the entire world or country move forward, rather than just in these little spots in far off places in the world. So if you could maybe connect up a little bit of the science and the known science to some of the things that, such as Kundalini and other some things that you were talking about, it would make it a little easier for people who are a little bit cynical to grasp.
Okay,
and I would appreciate that.
All right. Thank you, Joseph. And I assume you're listening on StreamLink out of Israel, so go ahead, Mark.
That's an excellent question, and I really appreciate that. How can we use that experience, that practice, in a practical way and study it that way? Gopi Krishna wrote along those lines, actually, and he came to the conclusion that Kundalini was the basis of genius. It's the energy that actually awakens and activates the other two-thirds of the brain that are normally dormant. And so I would say if there's a practical application and one that you can see in a lab, I would say that it would probably be that you could see an activation of certain parts of the brain that are normally dormant to become awakened. And I would say that within a lab environment, perhaps you could do certain Kundalini activation practices or alchemical practices to fire up the essence, what they call the Jing in China, to transform it into Kundalini energy to rise up to the spine to activate the rest of the brain. In China, it's believed that it's the Jing, the essence of your body, that forms up your brain, that feeds it all the time. And as you get older, your Jing wears down, which is why that you don't think as clearly, you don't hear as well, you don't see as well, Alzheimer's sets in. So Jing by itself will form up the brain, but transformed Jing, i.e. Kundalini, will not only form up the brain, but it will transform the brain. It will awaken those two-thirds of the brain. So this is a field of study that we could definitely get into that would be quite interesting.
How did you get involved in all of this, Mark, in the first place? You're a historian, you're a lecturer, and then all of a sudden, bang, you're doing this. What happened?
destiny? that's a hard one to define. It's just I feel like everything I do in life is leading to the next step. And for years, I was involved with reviving or helping to revive the goddess tradition via writing books on the esoteric history of the goddess tradition. And this is when I met Ian Sinclair, and he was ready to revive the goddess aspect of Templarism, the Gnostic, which is the Gnostic path of Templarism. And so it was right along with what I was doing, and I knew at that point that this is what needed to be done. And from that point on, everything just really flowed, and I knew that the goddess was really supporting this. And that also that the activation of Roslyn Chapel was a part of the reawakening of the goddess tradition. In fact, I met someone not long after meeting Ian. This was someone I met at the Prophets Conference who had just come from Roslyn Chapel, and she had been a deep worshiper of the goddess for some time. She's from Russia. And she started having these dreams when she was in Russia that she needed to go to Roslyn Chapel to do some work, to do some activation work. And she never even heard of Roslyn Chapels, but she went anyway and did this activation. And then later on, I met at the Prophets Conference. She says, "Okay, well now it makes sense now. You're talking about Roslyn Chapel and the goddess tradition, how they're interconnected." And she knew at that point that the activation of Roslyn Chapel was part of the revival of the goddess tradition, because William Sinclair made Roslyn Chapel to give people that Gnostic experience. He made it to generate that Holy Grail power that could create an alchemical response in the physical body that will eventually take you to that Gnostic consciousness. And there's actually a legend that eventually Roslyn Chapel will be reawakened and reactivated when a Sinclair female, a Sinclair woman comes back to sleep, and comes back awake, rather.
Now, what's
and
that mean?
We believe that this woman, this Sinclair woman, is the goddess herself. And so getting involved with Ian Sinclair and the Sinclair clan was very much in alignment with what I'd been doing with Kundalini, with Gnosticism, and the revival of goddess tradition. It was not at all inconsistent with these things.
Well, that could happen. How soon, then?
Oh, how soon? Well, we believe that it could happen very soon. Actually, there's Roslyn Chapel is part of seven Gothic cathedrals that were built over ancient Druid oracles all through Europe, and they mark the chakras of Europe. And in ancient times, the Druids and later on the Templars used to go on pilgrimage where they would start at the cathedral of Santiago de Compostela and go to the seven sites, Orleans and Toulouse and Notre Dame in Paris and Amiens, and they would end up in Roslyn Chapel. And so there was actually there's been some work done on that by certain authors like Tim Wallace Murphy, and they say that those chakras, those European chakras, also represent certain stars in the universe. They kind of represent the Milky Way, and at some point those stars in the universe are going to line up with those chakra points, and at that point there's going to be a reactivation, and that's when we really move into a new age. And I believe he said it was 2019 that he found that this was going to take place.
All right, stay with us. We'll come right back. We'll take final phone call. And welcome back to Coast, Mark Pinkham, our guest. Let's go right back to the calls. We don't have a lot of time. We have more callers than time. West of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hi there.
Hi. Thanks for putting me on the show, George.
Sure thing.
My question, it comes in two parts for Mark. One has to do with the Gnostic side of things. I was wondering about the significance of sound waves, such as, you know, white noise or, you know, how the Krishnas, they're chanting to use to induce this sort of Gnostic harmony thing that he's talking about. And the other side of things has to gets back more to the Templar side of things, where I was wondering what his thoughts were on the Merovingian bloodline and the Priory of Sion and their connection to the Templars.
All right, Mark, I'll let you start.
Good questions, and you could go. We could go the rest of the show in answering those questions. But I'll try to make it brief. The Gnostics used all kind of sound waves, mantras, to actually activate the process of alchemy within themselves. The Gnostic path evolved or descended from the goddess tradition, and within the goddess tradition, you're always trying to use energy or power to facilitate your alchemical transformation. You're actually trying to invoke the energy of the goddess herself, ultimately as the Kundalini Shakti within yourself. They use all kinds of energy power in the form of sound waves, in the form of light, in all forms of manifestation of energy. This is the way that they would invoke the goddess to work within them to...
Is it more of a harnessing of energy, or is it a releasing of energy?
It's both, actually. It's a harnessing of energy, but it's a major release of energy because, as I mentioned, we've got to clear away all the dust on our mirrors, which is certainly a major release. So it's actually both. And for the Merovingian bloodline and the Templars and the Priory of Sion, that is very, very difficult to prove. Of course, the idea is that the Merovingians are descended from the progeny of Jesus and Mary Magdalene and so forth.
Well, not only that, but the Merovingians, they were goddess worshippers as well.
Absolutely. You're right. Absolutely. And in fact, because of that, It's a better chance that they were actually descended from the Danans, the tribe of Dan, rather than the Benjaminites, which some of the thinkers today say that they were descended from, because they were people of the bear, and the bear is the symbol of Artemis, Diana. It appears as though it's more likely they were descended from the tribe of Dan, or the Danans, that once encircled the planet and were the Tuatha De Danann, they were the Danavas in India, they were the tribe of Dan, they were these miracle workers and magicians who were all Kundalini masters, and they came from both Atlantis and also from Lemuria in the east. And it's interesting to show the connection between the Merovingians and Atlantis. Supposedly they got their start with Merovich, whose mother supposedly she was out swimming, I guess, in the Mediterranean, and she had intercourse with this beast they call the Neptunius beast, which is interesting because Neptune was the patron of Atlantis, so that could show that story, that allegory could actually show the connection of the Merovingians to the Atlantean lineage.
Thanks so much, Mark.
Okay, thank you. Appreciate you being part of the program. Let's go on now to our wild card line. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi, this is Aaron from Washington.
Hi, Aaron. Go ahead.
I had a question. Does anywhere in the United States teach the alchemy? And I had a question about the San Pedro's cactus. Is that the same thing as peyote?
Okay. Good questions. San Pedro cactus, it's related to peyote. It's not the same. No, basically, peyote grows up here in Mexico and in southwest states. They're related in that both of them work by the alkaloids known as the mescalines. But San Pedro's mescalines are a little bit different than those of peyote. And also, the patrons of those two sacraments are very, very different. The patron of peyote is Mescalito, and he's kind of a trickster in a way, and And the patron or the deity of San Pedro is the goddess herself, which is why I prefer San Pedro, because she helps you to get in touch with the goddess within yourself through love, through intuition. You're feeling very, very supported, very safe all through your experience. So it's a little bit more peaceful than I have found than the peyote experience. So there is they are cousins to each other.
Let's go east of the Rockies, okay, because we're running out of time. You're on the air. Hi there.
Hi, George. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
I had two questions. Firstly, if you or Mark were familiar with the Jesus Mysteries and Jesus and the Lost Goddess, two novels that dealt with something called the Jesus Thesis, which is basically that the Gnostics were the original Christians and that Gnosticism initially was marrying Jewish mysticism with pagan beliefs, the Osiris Dionysus God-man being merged somehow with Moses, Joshua. And the second question had to do with the Gnostic concept of the God within us and the novel The Lathe of Heaven. Is it possible that in general that we could dream things into being, more specifically, if it were possible for someone, say, to see that movie about the hurricane, go to bed, have a dream, wake up, and then it happens?
Mm-hmm. First of all, the Jesus Mysteries, definitely the original Christians, I believe, were the Gnostics. The Gnostics came out of the Nazarene or Nazarene sect of the Essenes, which Jesus was part of. When Jesus left, he passed on the reins of his organization to James, his brother, who then continued that organization under the name of actually the Nazarenes, were also called the Ebionites. So they had some of the Gnostic wisdom, but there was also, of course, Saint John the Apostle, who carried on the Gnostic tradition even more so than did James and the Ebionites.
They had pictures in the one book of the baby Dionysus and his mother, and that later on that image could have translated into the type of image that the Roman Catholics used of
mm-hmm.
Jesus and the Madonna.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Oh, it was definitely connected to those ancient traditions. Jesus is believed he was, in our Templar tradition, we believe he studied down in Egypt and was initiated into the priesthood of Osiris and the Great Pyramid, and he also went east into India. He studied all different traditions, as did John the Baptist himself, too. So they assimilated and they synthesized all these traditions together.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
And the second question?
Go.
In terms of manifestation, I think I understand what you're talking about, and I've had that experience of being able to dream something into reality. I mean, in that respect, you're kind of having the same experience as the Australian Aborigines in the dream time. They essentially go into a state of meditation, which is a dream state, and through that dream state, they are actually able to manifest things on a physical plane. So it's pretty much the same experience.
Mark, any more books planned by you?
Not at the moment. I'm working very much on the Gnostic Templar organization right now. I'm probably going to be putting out a handbook on what it means to be a Gnostic warrior, Gnostic Templar. But if there is going to be books out, it's going to probably be related to the Holy Grail lineage. This is what we're really focusing on, is to be able to prove this lineage exists, and thereby we can show that there is a connection to East and West. And also I'm working on transforming this myth that we have of Jesus and the devil and Satan, because I believe it's based on a legend from the Far East, and it's a great distortion of that legend. And if I can bring to public consciousness the true legend, it's going to actually dispel a lot of fear and really raise the consciousness on this planet.
Let's go to our first-time caller line. Thanks for holding. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hey, George. This is Rick in Houston, Texas.
Hi, Rick. Go ahead.
I actually have a big question, kind of like I could say I'm a religious person, you know, definition of religion, establishing the relations between natural and supernatural parts of myself. Now, I wanted to ask this gentleman a great question. He seems to know an awful lot. What's the connection as far as the Knights of Templar, Masons, and I'm calling actually about maybe prophets in the Knights of Templars and the Masons, as far as, like, astrological aspects go of it.
What is the relationship between the Templars and the Masons in terms of...
like reincarnation and stuff like that. I know they do believe in reincarnation because I've read a couple different texts.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I think that you find in most of the Gnostic sects, even the Cathars, there was that the belief in reincarnation throughout all the Gnostic lineages. There was that belief because part of the Gnostic experience is actually being able to remember your past life.
That this is another thing. The reason I'm calling is I always feel compelled. Like the bloodline of the Holy Grail happened to fall into my lap one day from my ex coworker. He just gave it to me to read, and that's how it all started. And y'all mentioned earlier about this Chinese. What is it called? The Kling?
Tai Chi or
the
Jing.
The Jing.
Jing.
Might I say, George, your show has been my Jing.
Thanks, I appreciate that.
I'm very young. I'm 21, and y'all have opened up my mind in ways I can't explain.
Good for you.
Thank you for sharing with us.
We do that to a lot of people. Let's go to our wild card line. You're on the air with us. Hi there. Hello? Well, there's somebody there, but we're going to have to let him go. Go to our next wild card line. You're on the air. Hi there.
Hello, this is Larry from Cleveland.
Hi, Larry. Go ahead, sir.
I didn't know if you could hear me at first. I'm on a cell phone, so.
Yeah, you're okay.
In the beginning of your conversation with Mark. Hi, Mark.
Hello, Larry.
you had said something about secret society, and he kind of put it down. But when you said that, it had like a ring of a scripture to me, or the word of God, as I know it, the King James Version of the Bible. And you didn't get too many people contradicting you. Now, one thing, I'm not going to contradict you, but if the focus of what you're going is for a higher power, so to speak, and God had one son, Jesus Christ, then I think there's enough. There is certain venues of traditional Christianity that kind of are laughable in a sense, but I think God's Word, Old and New Testament, and the Torah, the Old Testament, I think, because of all the Judeo-Christian prejudices, I think the combination of those two books almost puts down, like, the laughableness of traditional Christianity in a sense, because I think there's a lot of, because when you said fundamentalism, it just had a, you know, it's got such a negative connotation now.
Yeah, I apologize if you thought that that's what I was doing, and I don't want to invalidate your path, that is your path, because I think there's a lot good to it. There's one of the great teachers that I have followed in my life is a great Hindu master, Ramakrishna Paramahamsa, and he was famous in his life for actually contracting his consciousness and following all the major traditions on the planet, and through them finding enlightenment. And he did follow Christianity, and that was just as valid as any other to take him to that goal. And I don't mean to, didn't mean to put down your tradition, because I think there's a lot to it, and it can take you to the goal.
Well, I guess I got to say one more thing too. In James, it says a double-minded man is unstable in all his ways, and I know there's a lot of contradictions, and we probably won't always be on the same page. But I guess my mind just sat down on me. How do you like that?
And here you go on national radio.
On national radio. Yeah, I guess where I'm going, I remember what it was. When I first got born again or became a Christian, I was at a church, and one of the elders was a Mason. And then I started reading stuff about the Masons, and one of the things they say up in the 32nd and higher degrees, they say one thing, but to the general populace, Mason, they say another thing. But they said basically, not, don't quote me, but I think you can, they said that Adonai gave Lucifer a bad deal. So I'm saying if a secret society is against Christian doctrine as I know it. I know there's some things that aren't right, but Jesus Christ is the only begotten of the Father, and that's the basis of Christianity. He died for our sins and was resurrected, and the faith in him is what leads you to a relationship with God Almighty, because he's just a title. The only name we've been given is his Son.
Right.
He stepped back in humility because his power, sinful man, couldn't go before him or he'd be obliterated.
Yeah, I appreciate that philosophy. I think that those in the higher ranking of Freemasonry might have a different experience of that. And
is that true, though? They say one thing to the higher Masons, and then they say nothing to the lower echelons?
I can't really speak to that because I'm not a Mason. I'm a Templar.
That's what makes it a secret society on one side, because they have they have oaths you take, and they have something for some people. But the Word of God is for everybody, and, mm-hmm. and it's in your face.
Well,
and
that's
you know.
That's the way we try to design our organization, or how we try to practice. So, what we are teaching is we want to invite everybody to become part of what we're doing, and there's nothing at all secretive on in any level of our path. So, we're open to everybody.
Let's go to our other wild card caller. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hey George, this is Josh in Wisconsin.
Hi Josh, go ahead.
Hi Mark, how you doing?
Hi, good. Nice to hear from you, Josh.
Hey, thanks. Well, I am a practicing Wiccan, so I'm close cousins to the Templar and the goddess belief, of course. Try to stay away from the more ritualistic, stylized part of it, but I completely appreciate what you're saying. And going back to the alchemy part, I was wondering if you've heard of an alchemical transmutation process dealing with the violet flame.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know if I've heard of the one that you have heard of, but certainly I have used the violet ray. I've invoked that, and that is something that I would encourage other people to do in our tradition, invoke the violet ray, as well as the patron of that ray, the Lord of that ray, which is Saint Germain. Saint Germain is an important master in our tradition. In fact, he was a Grand Master of the Templars in the 1700s, and so he in a lot of our alchemical rites we invoke him and his ray. So I'm not sure if that's what you're talking about, but that's what we practice.
You have a three levels in the order. Why is that?
Well, they're levels of progression, and with each level, there's a certain curriculum, there's certain things that you learn, squirelating and waiting, you learn a lot of Templar history, and you learn a lot of alchemical practices. In the Lady Templar, Knight Templar level, you learn how to become a Gnostic warrior, as we've been talking about, going beyond the fear, learning how to live in harmony with the life force. As a Fisher King and Queen, at that point you're eligible to have your own preceptor or your own center that you can teach within, and you can give initiation into the Squire and Lady in Waiting level. And then finally we've got the Grand Prior and Grand Prioress who has the authority to give initiation to all levels, and then they're kind of the last word in what happens within our organization.
All right. Mark Pinkham has been our guest. His book, Guardians of the Holy Grail. Mark, thanks so much for being on the program.
Oh, thanks very much, George. It's been a pleasure.
A different show, an educational program, something giving us something, of course, for us to ponder. For Steve Carr, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesour, Ian Punnett and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, I'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.